Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. Joining me in studio right now from the Houghton County Democratic Party is Horst Schmidt. Horst, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Rick. Glad to be here.
We'll be talking in this segment about the 2017 we'll call it the Republican tax bill, since it did not receive any Democratic support as it was moving through and then eventually signed by President Trump. We're looking back on it. There's not a whole lot anybody could really do about it now, but at least we can take a look at its intention and its effect. And I'll start off by telling the audience, of course, Copper Country Today is a nonpartisan program, and I'll be happy to talk with anybody out there that wants to, that's part of an organization, to come sit down and tell me how great the tax bill is and how it's wonderful for everybody. I imagine that it's not going to be your take on it, Mr. Schmidt, talk about it today. So I'll ask some questions. I don't claim to be an expert when it comes to tax law, either the old or the new, but, you know, everything, every day is an education process. So this is part of that education. So first of all, if you could tell me a little bit about the Houghton County Democratic Party and, you know, its involvement here in the local area.
Right. We have a monthly meeting at 7 p.m. at the Super 8 in Houghton down by on the canal. And this is where, you know, those of us who feel strongly about having a more holistic approach to dealing with life's problems is where we deal with these issues.
Now, I see, you know, oftentimes the your organization will promote different, whether their stances on political issue or as events, doesn't seem to be as much on the Republican side in the area. And I just kind of bring that up, is sometimes I've looked to see, you know, a counterbalance. And I see the Houghton County Democratic Party active. You had the office in Hancock. Do you still have that on Quincy Street?
No, we gave up.
Okay, yeah, that go away with that. But so, you know, from time to time, we talk to members from your organization. And your role in it?
Well, I'm on the political organizing committee, and that is the one that helps plan to what we're going to do during this election year.
All right. Talk about the, I guess, a little bit of history and different things that have led you to this point, both the party and yourself, to be taking this stance today.
Okay. Well, what I want to do today is say, you know, that Republicans and Democrats on the local level, you know, pretty much like the same things. You know, we want good-paying jobs, safe communities, health care, homes that we can afford, secure retirements, good schools for our kids. So, you know, when each side demonizes each other, and that's, you know, on the national level and somewhat on the state level, and then people pick that up on the local level, and then, you know, oh, that guy's terrible. Oh, look at what she's doing. You know, I mean, and so we lose sight of the fact that we all want the same thing. We do have differences, and so the message I'm trying to, let people know is that the differences between us and the Republicans is that the Democratic leadership made the American dream. And this is started, you know, when the Great Depression came and Franklin Delano Roosevelt came into power. And what he did is he helped spread the wealth during the Depression. It gave people hope. They were willing to then work. And then World War II came. And, you know, because of this hope and this optimism that Roosevelt created, people were willing to go to this war and fight these two terrible regimes. And so we won the war, obviously, and then after that we had some of the greatest prosperity in this country that we've ever had before. And that's what today's Democratic Party still stands for. We want everyone to be prosperous, not just the few.
Okay. Of course, party platforms have changed over the years. We've seen changes in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. I don't know if we've ever seen quite the climate we've seen now, at least not for many, many years. I can read some history going back to some of the troubled times in America's past, and there's a lot of vitriol and anger and rhetoric from both parties. But, you know, right now, certainly in my lifetime, this is as divided as I've ever seen us. Doesn't appear to be getting better. It seems to be getting worse. So I agree with your premise that, you know, everybody I believe, wants the same thing. I doubt there's very, very few people in the country that would like to see everything tanked and us not have homes or good education or good clean water or jobs for people. It's just how we get there. And so the Republicans have an idea. They have their tax bill believing that this will lead us to that promised land and get America back to work and start improving our lives. And so they put several things in there that they have told people that this is going to help achieve that. So go ahead and start breaking down some of that, some of those items right now. First of all, do you believe that the tax bill itself, just as a whole, is going to be disastrous or just have some problems with it? I guess how would you rank your feelings about it?
Well, I would like to say disastrous, but it's going to hurt people more than it's going to help them. It's basically a giant vacuum cleaner, and it's sucking up the wealth up to the 1%, much more so. For example, if you are making, say, $75,000 a year, you're going to get about $850 back on that tax return. And if you are making $1 million or more, you're going to get $51,000. Now, if you think about it, I would say probably about half the people in this country don't make $51,000. So I think that's what we have to look at is the fact that this prosperity that we have now is skewed. It keeps going up, up, up for the 1% and the 0.1%. So we're minting new billionaires all the time, and the people who are rich are getting richer. So we want to, you know, have what we did after World War II when we still had the New Deal. People were paying their taxes in proportion to what they were making, and we were able to build our interstate system, schools, new communities, roads, you know, the whole thing that allowed us to prosper, had the GI Bill, you know, which moved a lot of people into the middle class.
Okay. Now, some are going to simplify this and say, okay, you're just asking for higher taxes on the rich so that we can have more spending. And they'll also counter with what you had said is that regardless of what, you know, how small my tax cut may be for, you know, being in a lower income bracket, they can argue two things. One, it's still a tax cut. It's not a raise. So there's no logical way to say that I'm worse off than I was before. And then two, that, well, I pay a whole lot less taxes. So wouldn't it make sense that I would get less of a tax break? In fact, you know, as you mentioned, a lot of people don't make $51,000. A lot of people make less than that and pay less, with so many people who pay very little or nothing when it comes to income taxes on the federal level for a given year. So I'm sure you've heard those responses, and you know, what's your reaction to those?
Well, what we have to remember is if you avoid paying taxes, somebody else has to pay for that. So what you're doing is you're increasing the burden on a smaller and smaller pool and people who have less and less income. So how does the majority of people benefit? They are going to benefit apparently for 8 years under the current tax bill whereby they will get these tax breaks. But over time, as the tax law goes through its 8 years, the top 1% is going to be getting 83% of the tax breaks, and we're going to get the other 17.
Now, what about the argument that those tax breaks to the wealthier, they're also usually the ones who own the businesses, that those businesses would then be able to pass down some of those benefits to employees, perhaps like we saw with Walmart, with raising their minimum wage that they're paying their employees, or hiring more, expanding businesses. Those, you know, I hate that word. I hate the phrase, the trickle down, because it's just, it just automatically creates a bad connotation. But the thought is there that the if you provide tax relief to the business owners, and then it's better for everybody.
Well, remember, it is a trickle-down. This is what Reagan started with. And every time there's a tax cut, there's no economic growth. The studies have shown there's no change. A tax cut means less revenue. Tax cut means that somebody else has to pay for your share. So again, it's the same problem over again.
There are some disturbing trends that in, you know, the last 30 years where I've been, I can call myself an adult, that I've seen that is, we are seeing, you know, a shrinking middle class, and there's far more of a divide between those who are making very little and those who seem to be doing just fine and making quite a bit. And, you know, in fact, like in the position that the business that I'm working in, the average salary has not increased in a couple of decades. I mean, people in the 1980s are making about what I'm making now, doing what I'm doing right now. And I'm not alone in that. Minimum wage has come up, obviously, but a lot of other careers are making about the same. Whereas other careers, like say, if you're a Michigan Tech graduate, you're looking at a pretty darn good salary, a lot more than what you're going to, what you would have been making in the 1980s. So we're seeing that, you know, that I guess that a split being a whole lot more. The thought of that, you know, we're making that $30,000 to $50,000 a year was going to be enough to take care of yourself and your family. That bracket seems to be the one that's disappearing the most, and I think that's that middle class that, you know, paid, you know, its share of taxes, but then, you know, who's making $40,000 a year looking for tax loopholes or moving money offshore to be able to save money or something like that? You don't see that. You see that from the wealthier, and which, you know, can create that that view that they're doing everything they can to escape from paying taxes.
Well, the if you recall, in 1969, they closed down the mines and the mills here in the area. And so people lost their jobs. And that was a trend that started accelerating in the 1970s. So people who were relying upon the manufacturing sector lost their jobs. Their jobs went overseas. They didn't have any other jobs. They were, you know, Ohio, you had Cleveland, Toledo, and Youngstown, that were all the mills, and everything just shut down. So this is what the people who voted for Trump are upset about, is the fact that they've been left out of the American dream. And this is the same thing that is occurring now with the middle class. If you want to see what's going to happen to the middle class, all you have to do is look at the working class. They lost their jobs. They became the non-working class, so to speak.
Hmm. Now, when this tax bill was being put into law, there were a number of groups that were actively protesting, and one of them was student groups, even here at Michigan Tech. Can you explain that, what the impact is on for education with the tax bill? Because, again, it's a little hard to get clear answers if your main source is the internet. Everything's going to be, you know, pretty slanted one side or the other. But do you have that information? You know.
Yes, actually I do. I was watching this whole thing play out, in the sense that when you're a graduate student, you're taxed on the money you receive doing the teaching and grading chores as part of a student, or doing research for someone. And that's all you pay for on your taxes. But if you had been... let me rephrase that. If the tax bill had included the one where they would tax the tuition that the students did not have to pay, then that would have basically crippled them in terms of being able to make it, because most grad students aren't going to get more than something in the mid-20s at best. And so you know what rent and food and everything is like. You know, I remember when I was in college, we used to buy these packages of chicken, and they would say parts missing, and I always wondered which parts were missing. But when the price went up from 39 cents a pound to 43 cents a pound, that was a crisis for us. You know, and you know, I don't know if you're aware of it, but a number of organizations like Canterbury House have little food pantries for students who are too poor to purchase food and to pay their rent and their tuition. So this is what we're doing. We're wiping out a portion of our future, the people who we need in order to grow this economy, you know, to the knowledge economy, the digital economy, the economy that is going to be producing these driverless automobiles, because that's a major push in the engineering department here at Tech, and you know, they put in a whole bunch of investment down in the lower part of the peninsula for all this autonomous vehicle testing and research. So that gives you some idea. So if you're wiping out middle class jobs, who's going to be there to do it? Are we going to have to pull in all these foreign students to do the work for us because our students can't afford to go to school?
And my understanding is, well, they must listen to that blowback because that portion was taken out of the bill.
Right.
So they at least adjusted that. Now, I'm still trying, I guess, to characterize.
Well, let me just interrupt that. You know, the point is they were serious about doing it, but they listened to the people and said, you know, we can't do this. We're getting too many people against us. You know, when the bill was finished, they found out, well, only 26% of the people supported it. So does that mean the top 80% were the 20, and where did the other 6% come from? And so you wonder, you know, how are they going to do this? Well, what they said is, we need to do a better job of selling it. They didn't say anything about being transparent about the whole bill. We got to sell it. So what happened? A number of conservative groups said, we'll spend a few million dollars and we'll help you sell this bill. So there you had Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell smiling, you know, and saying, oh, look at all the great things. You're getting all these tax breaks. But they didn't tell you about the fact that the tax breaks ended in 8 years and that the tax break for corporations, which moved from, I think, 35% to 21% tax rate, you know, is going to be permanent. And remember, when you're talking about 21% tax rate, you're talking about 21% after you remove your deductions, because business can just about write off anything that it wants. One particular irony that I thought was really interesting, Netflix has an executive who's got $1 million in salary and $9 million in bonus. Well, in the tax bill, they removed the bonus thing as a deduction. So this year, guess how much he's getting?
Yeah.
Well, he's getting $12 million in the salary. So he's getting a $2 million raise. Plus, you know, he's doesn't have to work for the option. He's getting a straight salary. And that's totally deductible. We're paying for that. You know, as I was saying earlier, the corporation doesn't have to pay in taxes. We have to pay in taxes. So it's less than a zero sum game.
Okay, but speaking to that point, if the wealthiest bracket taxes went down, and same with the those not in that bracket, they also went down. How does the middle class and lower class end up having to pay more in order to compensate for that? Because overall, they've admitted it's like adding a million or trillion and a half to the deficit. They've acknowledged that, but it's not a trillion and a half in tax raises for everybody else except for the wealthy. I guess it seemed to be across the board, just heavily slated towards those who make more get more back.
Well, you see, that's the nefarious little game they play. You have this deficit that you increase it. You know, it's about $20 trillion right now. They want to add 1.5. People are saying that when you include the interest, that's going to actually be $2.2 trillion that we're going to have to pay back. And so what happens is that because we have to pay all this interest, then that justifies cutting spending. And usually the spending is in all the essential human services types of things. And defense usually is left alone. And Social Security is, at this point, is not in danger, but they are talking about cutting Medicare spending by $425 billion over a decade. So the momentum that they feel they have, it will allow them to carry on this cutting. So what do we do? Well, we cut taxes, And of course, growth is going to occur automatically because people have more money to spend. And you know, that's great. But if you let's say you have $20 million, $10 million goes to one person and $10 million goes to 75 people. Now, 75 people are going to have more of an effect on spending than one person with $10 million, because how many cars can you have? How many bathrooms can you have? How many clothes can you buy? I mean, how many houses can you own? I mean, it's limited by the sheer fact that you can't own that much and use it. So the whole point is that you spread the wealth again. You have more people spending. You have a growing economy. You have one person who owns everything. Everybody else ends up being a pauper.
Was the provision for the mandate actually for the Affordable Care Act removed? I know they discussed it.
No, I believe the requirement to have insurance is there. The penalty, I believe, was removed.
Okay, so what's the? How can they mandate something, but then there's no penalty?
Well, that's that's one of the geniuses of politics, isn't it?
So it's mandated, but nothing will happen if you don't.
Right, because they removed the penalty.
Okay, how does that affect the availability of the insurance through the so-called Obamacare or the cuts to Medicare you were mentioning?
Well, what I keep hearing is that the people who are healthy don't buy insurance. So if there's no mandate or there's no penalty to it, then they won't buy it. So then the rates will go up, I'm told, 10% a year for this new, more expensive pool of people who do need insurance. Plus, what happens then is you're able to reduce the subsidies. I think the number I saw was under $400 billion. I'm not sure, but it's some huge number that they can use as part of the tax cut again. So basically, again, you're cutting out part of that protective safety net that we have for us. This, you know, all of the stuff that we're seeing cut are things that occurred during the Roosevelt administration, and the Republicans have been dead set against this since the Roosevelt administration. They actually thought Roosevelt, you know, who was rich himself, was a traitor to his class. And so they felt that they had to keep on fighting. They didn't want Social Security. They've been trying to cut that down. Paul Ryan is the poster boy for eliminating Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. So basically, what are people going to do if they get sick? You know, because who's going to pay for their health care? There's no taxes for it. There's you know, you depend upon the kindness of strangers. And how much kindness can strangers afford?
One of the things when it comes to government spending and what they would use tax money for, I'd always been a big proponent of, you know, government should reduce the spending. They don't need as much money. People should be able to keep more of the money that they have. And as we've gone through a lot of political changes in the last several years, and I've looked more at things that were done, public works programs that were done in that time period that you were talking about, you know, our building of our interstate highways and things like that. And I think that really politically that got beaten like a dead horse with the fixing our roads and bridges, and it turned out to a lot of people was kind of just a scam to get more money to spend on other things. But the country does have a history of making good use out of, you know, both improving and building its infrastructure using public dollars and public, you know, putting people to work to do those things. And I wonder if we had that same sort of intensity that we had back in, say, the 1950s of really trying to build the country from within, that, you know, we would see a lot better living standards for everybody. But it's, you know, right now the two things that you pick the side of the line that you're going to be on. You either want, you know, low taxes and no government spending, and then those that want very high taxes and a lot of government spending, but not necessarily going to the things that are going to benefit everybody. And that's the political climate that we're in. my take, my two cents in on it all. But Horst, for people that want to, you know, find some more educational materials, maybe they want to get involved, are there opportunities in the local area for them to do so?
There's a lot of opportunity. You know, first of all, our party, if you want to be involved, this is the election year. This is the, you know, the countdown. We've got these great candidates, Scott Dianda, Ken Summers out of Baraga County is running for Scott's old seat. And then we have two excellent candidates running against Bergman. And Bergman voted for the tax law. So where is his loyalty at this point? But Matt Morgan, who's a retired Marine colonel, and Dwight Brady, who's a professor at NMU, are both running excellent candidates. You know, we obviously can't pick him until the voters decide in August that one or the other is going to be the candidate running against Bergman. But I think we have a really viable field. I think we have people who understand that the kind of things that are happening with a foul-mouthed president who constantly threatens, goes off on tangents, you know, has no discipline except to say no or you're fired, you know, if you're recall from his program kind of thing. So it's a... You know, what you said earlier, it's really tumultuous. We have not had this kind of craziness in my lifetime either, and I'm older than you, so I don't see it calming down because the media eats all of this up. It's like an opioid addiction, you know. I mean, and I get caught up in it occasionally too, in terms of that. But you realize after a while, you got to do real governing. You can't just keep on posing and saying, "Oh, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that." I'm going to promise. What, and in Trump's case, promise is a threat, as far as I'm concerned. So we keep seeing this like a real life reality show. I don't understand why people want to put up with that when their lives, livelihood, you know, the future of their children are at stake. You know, this is what we're really talking about. The fact that we cannot keep going on like this and expect people to be able to, you know, have a job that pays more than minimum wage. And, you know, Walmart, you mentioned, you know, has pay $1,000 bonus, but that's one time. $1,000, how many employees? I heard the rumor that it was, you had to be there 20 years to get that $1,000. They gave them pay raises. But point is, you know, this is what one commentator said. The wealthy and the corporations have learned that it's good to be nice to the little guy. And that's what it is.
All right. Horst, very interesting conversation. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you the next time.
And thank you for having me today.
Cover Country Today. We'll be right back.